joining in as we go. That typically happens. I'm gonna hit the recording stuff now, so that those of you who are already on, it's gonna start recording after I punch these numbers. Okay. Can people still hear me?
Yep.
I like to start these things on time. There's gonna be some folks joining in, as I said before. But just a quick housekeeping thing, if people could please put their phones onto mute. I understand that it's lunchtime for a lot of folks, but if you can keep the sound of chewing to a minimum, that's probably a good thing. So throw your phones on mute for those who aren't speaking. As most of you know, my name is Chris Lucas. I work for the AOA's ADDGS National Resource Center team. With me also is Diane Bronstein, the director of the team, as also is Jennifer Mitar, who is a public policy staff in the D.C. office, and our newest member, Tuidia Washington, who is absolutely a major administrative force now, which is great to have. Our speaker today, we're talking about Medicare Part B, specifically the Alzheimer perspective. That's where I do want to keep this focused onto the constituency that you all deal with. I know there's a lot of issues surrounding Medicare Part B. We're going to try and keep it constructive and keep it focused on the Alzheimer perspective. Speaking today is Leslie Freed, who's the director of the Medicare Advocacy Project for the Alzheimer's Association and the associate staff director for the American Bar Association Commission on Law and Aging. Also from CMS is David Chattel, who's the acting director of patient advocacy, and Denise Benning, from the Division of Community-Based Education and Assistance. CMS, of course, is the U.S. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And finally, rounding out the panel is Courtney Cherney, who is the Chief Operating Officer for the Area Agency on Aging of Southwestern Illinois. Thank you all for being part of this. I apologize if there's any echo that you're all hearing. I'll try and get rid of that as soon as possible. And also, Lori Staubbaum should be on the phone, correct?
I'm here.
All right.
I dutifully muted.
Okay, good. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to start right off and introduce you all to Leslie Freed. As I said, she's part of the American Bar Association and the Alzheimer's Association. The Medicare Advocacy Project that she works on is a collaborative project with the Alzheimer's Association, and she specializes in Medicare issues in response to Alzheimer's-related Medicare inquiries from local Alzheimer's Association chapters, and is, in general, an invaluable resource for people with Alzheimer's disease and those of us who work with Leslie and on these issues. So, Leslie, what I'd like to do is I'd like you to provide a little bit of background for us and then kind of get into some of the more meatier issues. But can you give just a very quick background to what Part D is, when it starts, and who's going to be affected by it?
Okay. Well, the Medicare drug benefit begins January 1st of 2006. Anybody who is on Medicare, entitled to or enrolled in Part A or B, are entitled to sign up for the Medicare drug benefit. It is for people who are currently on Medicaid, that's medical assistance, and getting their drug benefits through that. They will automatically be enrolled into a plan and start getting their drug benefits through Medicare beginning January 1st. They will no longer be getting their drugs through Medicaid. People can enroll. Let me take a step back. Is unlike Medicare Parts A and B, this Medicare drug benefit is different. Can someone put their mute on? Individuals will need to sign up for a private plan. This benefit is being provided solely through private plans, and people have to affirmatively sign up for a plan unless they're on Medicaid. Does that answer those first questions?
Yeah, perfect. Okay. Thank you. So what are the two ways now of getting prescription drug coverage through Medicare Part D?
Okay, as I indicated.
Okay. I'm sorry, could people please put their phones on the mute? And if you're receiving incoming calls for whatever reason, if it's making a sound, dial back in and see if you can disable that function on your phone before dialing back in. Thank you. Sorry, Leslie.
That's all right.
What are these two ways of getting prescription drug coverage?
Okay, as I said, the only way to get the benefit is through these private entities, these private companies, and there are two different types of plans. One is called a private prescription drug plan that only provides drug coverage. So somebody will pay a premium, and what they're paying for is this the prescription drug benefit only. It's called a standalone plan sometimes, or a prescription drug plan, or some people call them PDP.
Okay.
Initials. The second way is through what's called Medicare Advantage plans that have a prescription drug plan component. And this is very different. This is like a managed care plan, an HMO. So someone who signs up for a Medicare Advantage with prescription drug plans will be getting all of their their Medicare benefits through that organization. That's how they'll get their doctors covered and their hospitals and hospice, et cetera. So that's more of a comprehensive type benefit.
Okay. So there's these two ways of doing it. There's all these private companies. How many plans are there to choose from in each state? Is there a general number? And what are the pricing structures?
Well, let me tell you the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services did was divide the country into regions. And there are two different sets of regions depending on whether it's a prescription drug plan. There are 34 prescription drug plan regions, and then there are 26 Medicare Advantage regions. So it depends on where someone lives. They'll have to look at the map and determine what region they are in. And on the Medicare.gov website, there are maps of the country, and there's these things called landscape, which we'll get into later, which will tell will show what region each state is in. But in general, there's for the standalone plans, the prescription drug plans, there are between 11 and 23 organizations in each state, and each organization can offer more than one plan. And generally, my calculations show there are between 27 and 52 plans offered in states. So some states have as few as 27, and I think one state has as many as 52 standalone plans. Similarly, for Medicare Advantage, where there are 26 regions, Alaska has no Medicare Advantage plans, I don't think, and there are up to 37 companies in other states, and similarly, 0 to 257 plans offered in the state. So there's a lot of options out there.
Okay.
And you asked how are they priced, what the premiums are? Well, that's a very formula developed by Medicare. What happens is the plans have to fill out an application, and there's a lot of information that goes in there, and then they have a proposed premium. And all that information is on the Medicare website, but it's a pretty complicated formula. But the actual premium is on the website, and that's one thing that cannot change. So for the year.
For the year.
That people are frozen into that premium for the year.
Okay. Speaking of prices and such, you mentioned the website, the Medicare.gov website. Jennifer Mitar in the D.C. Public Policy Office here at the Alzheimer's Association spent a considerable amount of time looking at states' plans and doing a lot of the early legwork, and I was hoping, Jennifer, you could talk a little bit about what the website used to be like, what it's like now, and some of the information that you were able to pull out of it, state-specific.
Yep. They've done a lot of work on the website since it first went up. Initially, they didn't have good tools for calculating costs, but now there's great tools. You can actually go on the website, enter your zip code, enter the medications that you're currently on. You need to decide whether you want the standalone plan or the Medicaid Advantage plan, and it will generate a list for you of plans, the drugs they cover, and the estimated annual cost that each of those plans will be. And from that information, you can choose which would be best for you.
So this is something that people, that our grantees, depending on their experience, and this is something that's become a little easier.
It's very easy to navigate now. You go to medicare.gov, and the two most important tools are the formulary finder, where you can enter your drugs, and it will tell you what kind of limitations each plan puts on those drugs, such as you need prior authorization from your doctor to have the plan cover that drug, or you need to go through step therapy, which is trying different cheaper generic drugs first. And then you can go to the Find a Prescription Drug Plan Finder, and that will generate the estimated cost for you.
Wonderful. And you know, you mentioned things like prior authorization and step therapy, and that sort of brings us a little bit back to Leslie here. Can you talk about what is getting into the Alzheimer's-specific stuff now? You know, what are some of the special considerations for people with Alzheimer's disease?
Okay. First, let me say that through our advocacy efforts, we are thrilled that every formulary, every plan in every state must have at least two of the cholinesterase inhibitors on their formulary, so two out of the three, and some of them have all three. In fact, our analysis has showed many of them have all three. And every formulary must have memantine on their formularies. And let me tell you, we didn't tell you what a formulary is. And for those who don't know, a formulary is a list of covered drugs. Not every plan is going to cover every drug. They're not required to. They are required to cover at least two drugs for every class or category or type of drug for each disease, but they don't have to cover them all. So for Alzheimer's drugs, they have to cover at least two of the cholinesterase inhibitors. And memantine is in a class of its own. They all have to cover memantine. In addition, there are special rules regarding certain classes of drugs, and the Medicare agency has said that all the plans have to cover all or almost all antidepressants, antipsychotics, and anticonvulsants. And those are drugs that are often taken by people with Alzheimer's disease for to control certain symptomology.
And as a note, Leslie, a brief interruption, all those drugs went out to the grantee list recently when we sent out the reminder agenda.
Oh, so okay, good.
Folks should have a copy of that, as well as a quick and easy way to help people through Medicare.gov.
Oh, okay, great. Those are real. It's really important for people to look at the use the tools on the Medicare.gov or have a family member help them, probably, because it's important that the drugs they take, or at least the most expensive drugs they take, are on the formularies. And for drugs that are most often taken by people with Alzheimer's disease, many of those drugs will be on the formulary. However, it's worth noting, as Jennifer stated, that many of them have what's called prior authorization requirements, which means the plan must approve the drug before it gets paid for. So the doctor often has to provide some sort of information to the plan to get prior approval.
Okay. Please put your phone on mute. So what can be done to help individuals with cognitive impairment? You know, we know the drugs, we know about the plans, we know about some of the special considerations. So what are some things we should be thinking about doing?
Well, I think one issue that we need to mention is that many people with cognitive impairments don't understand them, and they may not even have the capacity to understand it. And the question is, who can provide assistance to them and who can actually enroll them? And Medicare, the federal government, has said that pretty much almost anyone can provide objective assistance with individuals who are deciding on what plan to choose. But there are much more significant limitations on who can actually enroll them or enroll someone on their behalf. And that's pretty much limited to people who have some sort of authority under state law, such as someone with the power of attorney or a guardian, or in some cases, in some limited cases like in Florida and Oregon, their surrogate decision makers, family members, can make those decisions.
And that's something we're going to be expanding on, I know, when Denise talks, because she's really going to be focusing on those special considerations.
Oh, okay. So, but that's something to keep in mind.
And
go on.
And then my last question really was, you know, just to give a kind of an idea of some of the grassroots activities that our grantees or, you know, their partners might be able to participate in. What are some of the things that we can be doing as far as events or...
Well, David might be talking about some of the outreach efforts, et cetera. But I think we've done, and you can look on the ALZ.org website, is we've done several fact sheets on which talk about the special considerations and how to choose a plan for someone with Alzheimer's disease. They're one page long. Some of them are two pages. I think it's crucial that people enroll. This is an important benefit. And even though there's quite a bit of confusion about the plans, it's not a 20-minute decision. This is something that will take some time, just like it takes time to make decisions, important decisions regarding any other insurance, from car insurance to automobile to home insurance or life insurance. So given all the options, it does take time. So I would encourage you all to talk to your constituents, encourage them to enroll, talk with their caregivers. You may have some sessions in your community that the local senior health insurance, state health insurance counseling program is putting on, that maybe CMS is putting on, or the local health and human services or AAA is putting on. Encourage your caregivers to attend. I would hand out the fact sheets we developed because they're really geared towards people with Alzheimer's disease, and hopefully they'll provide some guidance. They won't say which plan is best, but they'll tell you sort of how to go through the process and what to look at. And what's really important is to remember that each state may be different depending on what region folks are in. So if you're talking to a family member who says, well, my sister in Virginia said this is a good plan, well, if you're in Missouri, that may not be the same. That's not going to be the same plan, or it may not be. So it's important to remember that.
Okay. Thank you. And we'll be making all of these handouts that you're mentioning available to grantees folks on this call.
And then I'll be available. I think we have Q&A at the end.
Yes. And you know, you had mentioned Dave Chitella, and I wanted to move on to sort of his area of expertise. As I mentioned, he's the acting director of patient advocacy at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, where he's been since two Decembers ago in 2003. He's responsibility for working with national health agencies and other advocacy groups focused on disability and mental health issues. Currently, he's focusing on building relationships with these groups, determining current plans of organizations for outreach related to Medicare prescription drug coverage, and facilitating collaboration between CMS and these groups. And so David, if I could start off and just ask you, you know, from the CMS perspective, how is this outreach structured, and, you know, what is the objective?
Oh, thanks, Chris. Again, before I answer that question, one of the things I'd want to do is hopefully people on the call have a pencil or a pen and paper, and they can take down my email address, which I'll share. Again, it's david.chatel, C-H-A-T-E-L, at cms.hhs.gov. And I would encourage people to send me any questions that they may have, even after the call. And I will certainly look through what resources we have to provide detailed information if I can, and find the right expert within CMS if I need to go outside my own area of expertise, and also provide to them links to specific information if they need that, because I know sometimes that this is something that people are just getting into right now. They may not have all the resources right at their fingertips. And as Leslie mentioned, this is a current issue. People really need to be thinking about it right now. In terms of the CMS perspective, in terms of outreach, I would say our bottom line objective is to make sure that 42 million people out there with Medicare make confident and informed decisions, and they make the right decisions about Medicare prescription drug coverage for them. And in some cases, that may include the fact that Medicare prescription drug coverage is not right for everyone. people may have what is called creditable coverage, which means they have coverage that's already provided to them that is as good or better than a Medicare prescription drug plan. And for those people, they certainly can choose to keep their current coverage if they choose to do that. So our bottom line beyond that is to make sure that the other people that need to make a decision about drug coverage, that they make an informed decision about what plan will meet their needs. In terms of the structure, we have a very broad and very deep structure in terms of outreach to people. It is both a national, a regional, and a local campaign, and it's carried out in three phases. We've been in the awareness building phase, and now we're in the decision-making phase because people can actually enroll in a plan, and we'll be moving next year into the urgency phase because there is an initial deadline for this initial period of May 15th for people to select a plan. So we have three phases to the campaign. We are working through all the major typical sources of trying to reach people through the media. That includes broadcast media, print media. It includes advertising that we've done both at the broadcast level as well as within print media. Perhaps some people have seen our insert within Parade magazine that was back at the beginning of November. There was just a town hall meeting that was broadcast November 19th on CNBC, where Dr. McClellan held a town hall meeting about the prescription drug coverage. We go from the very high level of broadcast media and print down to the very local level and everywhere in between. And in order to do that, we have networks within HHS, the Health and Human Services. Multiple components within HHS are very involved in this. Particularly a couple of key components, the Administration on Aging and the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. They are all working with grants down through to the local level and contracts with agencies trying to get information out to targeted audiences. In addition to that, on the government level, we have partnerships with all of our sister agencies within the federal government to reach out as they can to people with Medicare. So, for instance, we're working with Housing and Urban Development because they deal with low-income housing, and they have a whole network of people that work within low-income housing units, and they're being able to. We're working with the Department of Transportation because there's low-income support for transportation for people. We're working within the Department of Agriculture because they deal with food stamps. Just again,
David, hold on for just a second. I hope that's not the vendor's issue right now for the call, but if you're on a cell phone perhaps, or if your phone is up against something that was almost like Velcro, please put it on mute. David, go ahead.
Okay. And all of this is geared to try to connect to the ultimate consumer, the people with Medicare. And we recognize that it can't be done just by the federal government. It needs to be done through all the other government agencies, whether it's state or local officials. And we're really counting on outreach through the thousands of organizations that are involved with us. This is also done through the CMS regional offices. There are 10 regional offices, and they have a campaign structure out there to try to reach to every state, and within each state to multiple organizations down to local government levels as well as with many organizations.
And how do they go about doing that?
In terms of outreach to the states?
Right.
Well, each area has outreach to many community organizations, and for an example, I'm heading up two major national campaigns, and those are two of 20 national campaigns. The two that I'm working on are outreach to health agencies, and the other one is to disability/mental health organizations. And each of those 20 national campaigns within the campaigns has a mirror organization at the regional level. So they have regional contact people tied into those groups. I'm dealing with about 50 major national organizations and providing resources to them, asking those organizations to then feed information down through to their local affiliates. For instance, the Alzheimer's Association has done that very effectively. But also, we provide the information to our regional offices, and they're asked to connect to all those local organizations. And I share with them my contacts for the national voluntary health agencies nationally. So, as you can guess, it's a very complex structure trying to reach out down to the very community level and ultimately to individuals who will help people with Medicare make the right decision, because we recognize that for many people this is going to be something that they will need someone to really take a personal interest in, sit down with them and deal with them one-on-one and answer their questions, get their information, get the information about what medications they take and what pharmacy they choose to get their medications filled at, and plug that into a computer system to make the decision easier.
And we have a great example of that coming up. So.
Sure. One of the things that I wanted to mention is we do fund the, I think something that Leslie referenced, the state health insurance assistance programs. We fund them. They're frequently called SHIPs, and there's a way to access the location of a local SHIP. There's a www.shiptalk.org. That's a website to locate the local SHIP for any area. And they have trained counselors who are able to sit down one-on-one with people and do that, as well as the area agencies on aging do that very effectively.
Excellent. Thank you for the resource. And we'll be putting together all the resources that all of our panelists mentioned and carving them out to everybody on this call. And of course, this will also be recorded and will be available on the AOA website. So, you know, David, you mentioned that, you know, we need to be reaching out, we need to be talking to people who are facing this situation, and that particularly our grantees, while they may not initially be thought of as the first Medicare Part D resource, certainly for a lot of the folks that they're reaching out to as part of their direct services, will probably contact them at some point regarding Medicare Part D, and specifically because, you know, they're in a position where somebody has Alzheimer's disease or they're caring for somebody with Alzheimer's disease. So what can our grantees do, the people on the phone now, what can they do to better prepare themselves to be a resource on this issue?
Well, and I really think that it's important for everybody, as sort of a good American, to take on this role. I've often used the example that if my parents were alive, I would be doing this with them. But in the meantime, I've offered to all my friends and people my resource, my own personal resource to them for their parents and any of their loved ones that need to be making this decision. And I think anyone who is computer savvy and literate really should be taking this on, because it's a issue that affects not only 42 million people with Medicare, but it affects the whole country. I mean, everyone knows someone either in their family, their neighborhood, loved one, that can use this assistance. So if you have access to a computer, you're fairly computer savvy, it's something that people should become informed about. And I know that Leslie also already mentioned our website, but let me, again, if people have a pen and paper, if they could take that down and make sure they know that. It's www.medicare.gov, and that is our public website. But I also would like for people to know our partnership website, and this is for organizations and access to a whole lot of materials that people can get access to, and that is www.cms.hhs.gov, and that has access to all kinds of printed materials, publications, all kinds of fact sheets, tip sheets, outreach kits. And people can go on there and order, download the information, print it out themselves, or order the information. And I would encourage them to do that, to become educated. I think certainly within a day, someone could become fairly knowledgeable about this if they ordered the information, took it home, and made it their nighttime reading. And then in terms of accessing the Medicare.gov website, that was something that's already been mentioned, and I think we'll talk about it a little bit more, accessing that and going on and comparing drug plans. It's something that I've done myself, using medications that I take to determine what plan would be best for me if I was on Medicare. And it doesn't take very long to become fairly proficient at using it. And so that's something that I would encourage everyone to learn, both for access and so they can be information resources for people within their organizations, but also they can be resources within the neighborhood, certainly within their family and friends.
Good advice. You mentioned what's worked so far, organizations like the National Health Council, working with the Alzheimer's Association, or health agencies within the federal government, and you know, you've given some good advice as far as how to, you know, what our grantees can do themselves. But, you know, what is the remaining challenge that's left, or the remaining challenges, and what is that last message you'd like to make sure that our grantees can carry.
Well, I guess an overall really important message that this is important for people to pay attention to right now. That's, I mean, so that for everyone on the line, if you can spread that word, that this is not something to put off, it's not something to ignore. Whether or not you know someone or have someone in your family with Medicare, you really need to be paying attention to it. There are two major issues that I'd like to stress. One is, this is an extremely valuable benefit for people, particularly who are low income. Leslie mentioned people with Medicaid are automatically going to be enrolled in a Medicare drug plan. They certainly have the option to select one. But for millions, I mean millions of people who currently may be going without prescription drugs, or for people who can't afford them and are perhaps taking less medications than they should because they can't afford it, this is a plan that's available to people of limited income and resources, and there are millions of people who have not yet applied for that. There's certain categories of people who are automatically eligible, but millions of people need to apply. So the ones that are automatically eligible are those, of course, with Medicaid, the people that receive SSI, and those people that get support from the state to pay for Medicare. Other than that, people that are low income, and again, it is millions of people, can apply for this coverage through Social Security. And so we'd encourage people to spread the word. If you're low income and need to take prescription drugs, and even if you don't, apply for this coverage. It's those people pay no premiums. For those people, there is no deductible, and the copays are very, very small, $2 and $5. So that's the primary message we want to get out on that. And finally, that there might be some people out there who are saying, well, I'm healthy, I don't need to take any prescription drugs, so I'm not going to do this. And that we'd encourage those people to take a second look. There is this initial sign-up period, and it ends May 15th. For those people who don't sign up by May 15th, there will be a penalty of 1% per month added to the premium. And there is only one open enrollment period per year for most people, and that's November 15th through December 31st of each year to take effect the following year. And so if people delay until after May 15th, they miss out for 6 months. They won't be able to sign up, and then they will pay a penalty as well. So this is important for people to be making a decision about now.
Thank you. Thank you, David. Earlier, I'd actually like to get Denise involved now. I mean, Denise, earlier Leslie had mentioned, you know, something about surrogacy issues and, you know, objective observers, and it really brings up this idea of people in nursing homes who might not have somebody making decisions for them right now. So thinking of them as sort of an abandoned beneficiary, what needs to be taken into consideration for these folks?
Well, Chris, the primary thing that needs to be taken into account for these beneficiaries is who has the legal right to make a decision on their behalf. CMS recognizes, obviously, the self-authority of the beneficiary, him or herself, to make an enrollment decision. Following that, it would be someone who has power of attorney for that beneficiary if they are incapacitated and can't make cognitive decision on their own. But beyond that, it really reverts to the individual state laws. And I know that this is not an answer that everybody wants to hear. I think everybody would prefer that there be some kind of a national law on this, but it really does go back to state laws and what applies in each state, what is allowable. In some states, it might be a physician or a nursing home staff member, or it may go so far as to having to have a court-appointed guardian for that person. But it's whatever the state law allows, we will accept.
And what might some of those resources be? I know, you know, why can't you just make a national policy?
Well, a national policy would then put us in a position of having to deal with 50 different state laws that are already on the books in many cases. So it would be a very cumbersome process, and again, one that usurps the state's right to determine for their residents what is allowable in their state.
So our grantees who want to find out what is allowable in their state, where do you suggest they look? Where should they start looking?
Well, obviously the Internet is a great source if you Google in, you know, surrogacy or a a search term like that in any given state, it will likely pull up the information for you. Barring that, there's always the state attorney general's office, the state insurance commissioner's office. As Dave and Leslie had mentioned earlier, the state health insurance assistance programs might also have some information on what is allowable in their state. So there are a number of different resources out there.
Great. So getting into some of the things that both Dave and Leslie have mentioned, those who are dual eligible, Medicaid and Medicare, mm-hmm. What happens to those folks who, you know, how do decisions get made for them?
Well, there are obviously two ways that decisions get made for them. One is that they make their own decision if they have the capacity to do that. If they don't have capacity, then it would go to whoever has power of attorney or, again, whoever has authority under state law. But one of the concepts that is very germane to this population in long-term care facilities, and I know that many of our Alzheimer's patients are in these types of facilities, is the fact that they really need to have continuity of care. And 70%, we estimate, of residents in long-term care facilities are full benefit dual eligibles. In other words, they're getting their Medicare coverage through Medicaid, and all of their drugs are currently being paid for by the state Medicaid program. That changes, as we had talked about before, on January the 1st. Medicare takes over. And there are some changes in the program in that there are different formularies, different plans, and there really has to be choices made for this very vulnerable population. For those who are full benefit dual eligibles, the law calls for them to be auto-enrolled randomly in a Part D plan so that when January 1st rolls around, there is no discontinuation of their drug regimens. Especially in a nursing care setting, it's really critical that the drugs are continued without interruption. So what we are working on from a long-term care perspective is not only the fact that everyone is eligible for Part D benefit and that they must take action in order to get that benefit, but in addition, important messages about continuity of care, that if you are a full benefit dual eligible, you will be auto-enrolled in a plan in your area. And that if you do not, if you cannot make a decision, you can stay in that plan. If you have the ability to make a cognitive decision, you can change plans. There are a number of special provisions for this vulnerable population that are specific to them, some of which include the fact that they can change plans as often as they wish while they're in a long-term care setting. Monthly if they want to. The fact, again, that they have no co-pays, no premiums, no deductibles, and the fact, again, that they will be auto-enrolled in a plan so that there will be no discontinuation of their benefits. So those are things that are very important that we're trying to communicate, of course, directly to beneficiaries, but most importantly to their family, their friends, and their caregivers.
I think it's something, it's important to point out something that you had mentioned to me yesterday, which was, as far as continuity of care issues, it's not only if a drug is covered, but how it's covered.
That's very true. The formularies that have been developed for the Part D benefit are incredibly robust, and most all of someone's needs would likely be covered under the Medicare benefit because it requires all types of drugs commonly needed by Medicare beneficiaries to be included. So it's, I know that there are some drug exclusions in certain instances by law that Part D cannot cover, but it appears to us that the state Medicaid programs are picking up these drugs, and what I'm specifically referring to are the classifications that are known as barbiturates and benzodiazepines. So that it really, when you look at the entire spectrum, the issue of someone being on a drug that is not covered really comes into play, because there are a number of different options available to a beneficiary. They can obviously ask for an exception. That is basically an appeal process. If they need a drug that is medically necessary and their doctor certifies that, then they can appeal to the plan for an exception to have that drug covered. The other thing that we're working very closely with medical directors of nursing homes on is transition plans, making sure that if we run into a problem with a beneficiary where for some reason they have to be transitioned to a similar drug that they're on, what they're on currently, that that's affected in a way that doesn't put them at any kind of medical risk, and that's done appropriately from a clinical standpoint. Every plan also has to have a long-term care pharmacy component in order to participate in the Part D benefit. What that means is that they have to make sure that anyone in a long-term care facility in their coverage area has total access to drugs at all times. And that means contracting with long-term care pharmacies that provide 24-hour coverage 7 days a week, that provide appeals processes through the plan, that has appropriate packaging like bingo cards or blister packaging, and some other requirements. So that was written into the law to make sure that the needs of this very vulnerable population have been met.
Okay. Thank you, Denise. I want to take some of these things that you and Dave and Leslie have all talked about and now work it into sort of how do we translate all of this information to people. Dave mentioned that, you know, you really need sort of this one-on-one interaction, and that's precisely the expertise of the next panelist, who's it's Courtney Tierney, who's the Chief Operating Officer, as I said, for the Area Agency on Aging of Southwestern Illinois. Courtney is a gerontological social worker. She works in public policy for the Illinois on the Illinois Chapter Network for the Alzheimer's Association, and has a very interesting event that was launched yesterday, and I'll ask her to talk about that. But Courtney, starting off, you know, what are the emerging issues that you see from your work on the ground?
Thanks, Chris. It's nice to be asked that question because a lot of decisions are made without contacting the folks on the ground who we've been involved in this every day for the last, 18 months back with the Medicare prescription drug card. And we've enrolled folks every day since those started. We've had a great deal of success with it. I know there were a lot of folks that were confused by those prescription drug cards, but for us, it was a wonderful dress rehearsal and a wonderful opportunity to build the infrastructure that was needed. We've got to reach more people. It takes one-on-one. It takes 45 minutes. You need internet connection, and Medicare.gov needs to be up and running to really do it. It takes people. We have the sites, we have the events, we have some computers, but we need people, and we need people that are trained locally because of the different nuances with the states and the state programs and the different nuances between the programs. For example, in Illinois, if folks are all trained up in Chicago and then they come down here, a lot of the plans don't operate here in the counties that we have. So it needs to be local training. It takes a process. We've done the general education, but now people want specifics. And each person has different specifics because we're all unique. And it's very difficult when you're doing education events, when you start talking about this and you say, well, if you have Medicaid, it's this. If you have an employer program, it's this. And it comes off looking very, very complicated. But when you sit down with one person and do their situation, it's not near as complex. Now we need to provide them with their options. What we do is we give them the three top options and, of course, let them decide. We are finding that people are not quite ready to enroll. They've been educated. We work with the options, and then we say, are you ready? And they go, no, I need to think about this, or I want to sleep on it, or I want to talk to my spouse or my son or my daughter or whatever. Then we contact them again, or they'll call back, or we'll have a second event, and then they will decide, and we do the enrollment. This is not like when we did the polio vaccine. That's pretty easy. Line up, go through line, get it. This is much more complex.
Well, what are some of the activities you're doing to accomplish this? I know there's something. There was a launch of
My Medicare Matters.
Medicare Matters. Can you tell us a little bit about that and kind of how that's set up? I thought it was very innovative.
I'm sorry?
I thought it was very unique and innovative.
It is. But pharmacists are a group that needs to be reached as well. With the My Medicare Matters, it's pretty cool. It's in 37 markets, large markets in the nation. It is nationwide through the National Council on the Aging and the Access to Benefits Coalition. We are the coalition catalyst agency for the St. Louis metropolitan area. So I encourage you all to contact your local Access to Benefits coalition to find out the local events. What My Medicare Matters does is they have a van, and in the van are five or six of these. They're computers. They are internet connected. They're kind of like laptops, but they're bigger than that. They call them kiosks. They are wireless. Plus, they have these smaller computers, and then there are trained educators that go with them. So they come to an event, they set up, and there are people, which is what we need, and the equipment, which is what we need. We had an event this morning at a senior center. They expected it to take 4 hours. It took less than two because there were 20 people, and there were plenty of people there to enroll them and sign them up. There was the equipment and the people. It worked beautifully. Yesterday was the national launch of this program in St. Louis, and we had probably 75 older people, but the website was down. So then we couldn't do the plan finder, and we couldn't do the enrollment. So these people are there for something, and that's a challenge. We work with a worksheet. We get their information, so they haven't come for anything. But then we have to go back when the website's up, put the information in, and then recontact the person with what we found.
That's excellent. So even that, when that challenge approaches, you have certainly a safety net. While it's not ideal, it still continues the conversation.
Oh, yeah. And they have already established the contact. We had done focus groups and found out that people wanted free confidential help, but they wanted it from a trusted local nonprofit that was peer-to-peer. And so when they come to their local senior center or their local agency that they know, they are much more comfortable giving the information that they have to give in order to find the plan, because it is, I mean, they're all HIPAA compliant. We've got them all signed in on that end, but this is serious stuff, and if the information gets in the wrong hands, trouble can happen.
That's a good point. What I'd like to do now is I'd like to open it up for questions from the grantees or whoever else is on the phone. I would ask you to please identify yourself, your name, and your state, and also make sure you take your phone off mute. But we have some really great minds on this topic here. I want to caution you against not asking a question because you feel it might be too simple. This really is the time to ask anything that's on your mind. There's some, like I said, there's some really brilliant people on the phone who are here to answer your phone call. Not me, obviously, but the other folks. And please, anyone step forward and ask your question. We'll try and have the right person answer it for you.
Okay. This is Patty from Indiana, and I have a question for David Chattel. I have this is a very simplistic question again, but I'm not going to be embarrassed about asking it. I have an elderly sister who's not on any medication. She's very fortunate. But how do I convince her that she should, well, first of all, should she get on the plan? I mean, things can change in a year. And then she would have to pay this extra premium that, say, if the premium's $30 a month, so we're talking like 1%. So if my math is correct, that would only be like an extra 30 cents a month? Or, I mean, is it really worthwhile to counsel older people who aren't on any medication to get on plan now and pay all this money when they really don't need it?
Well, I will give you my explanation of it, and you can see whether that would fit with her. Of course, I've got to say, probably not everyone will be convinced. But this is like any other insurance product, and you hopefully never will have to use it. But particularly if she's elderly, the odds are that at some point she may need some prescription medication. And if she does, there, as I mentioned, there is only this one open enrollment window for most people, and that's from November 15th to December 31st of every year, and that's to take effect the January 1st of the following year. So if she waited past May 15th of this year, she couldn't enroll until the following January. Now that's 7 months, so you mentioned 1%, but it's 1% per month, so she'd be paying a 7% increase. But meanwhile, if she didn't enroll in that November to December time period, she couldn't enroll until a full year after that. So there's another 12%. So if she waited a year and a half, we're talking really 19% increase. And so that's one perspective. The other is she could get sick and need some medication, say, in January of a given year, and she wouldn't be able to enroll until the following year. And so the entire cost, and it could be that she would need some expensive medications. This helps to provide what we call peace of mind so that she knows she's got some coverage. The other side to this, it depends on what state she's in, but she should go in and look at what are the premiums for each of the plans in those states. And in some states, the premiums are as low as $1.86. The $30 might be more of an average cost, but every state has, except for Alaska, has a plan with a premium below $20 a month. So for as little as about $250 a month a year for sure, she could have the peace of mind, and you as a family member could have the peace of mind. In case she got sick at the beginning of a year, she wouldn't have to go that entire year without coverage. And then she buys into the fact that she doesn't have to pay this penalty. If she were to choose it, say, 3 or 4 years down the road, she could be paying as much as 40 or 50% higher on the average premium then. So those are all the reasons that I would be giving to my parents if I were to talk to them.
Can I add just two more comments? This is Leslie. One is that it's 1% per month forever. So it's not just for a short period of time. It's that financial penalty is for as long as someone's in the plan. So it could be 50 years or 30 years. In addition, the premiums, the current premiums, I can assure you, will go up. So in 4 or 5 years, we might find that our average premiums are much, much higher. So when you're adding 19% to a very, a much higher premium, it could be a significant cost.
Thank you.
The next question. Thank you, Dave and Leslie. Anyone?
Well, this is Kathy Brill.
Kathy, where are you from?
Seniors Plus in Lewiston. I work with caregivers for Alzheimer's and other loved ones that have a form of dementia. I thought everybody had till May 15th, but I keep hearing January 1st. So I'm a little bit confused about that.
The benefit itself begins January 1st. So people who have enrolled by December 31st can start taking advantage January 1st. But people do have until May 15th to enroll.
Okay, so let's say they enroll in February. Then when does their coverage begin?
March 1st.
Okay.
So the first of the next month?
Yeah. If I can ask something, this is Denise Benning. Where you keep also hearing the January 1st date is for full benefit dual eligibles who will lose their Medicaid prescription drug coverage as of that date. That's why it's critical for full benefit dual eligibles to make sure that they have their coverage either through auto-enrollment or through self-enrollment.
And can people who are, this is Leslie, who are the dual eligibles, the Medicare and Medicaid folks, they should have already received a yellow letter which says, tells them what plan they have been auto-assigned to or enrolled in, which, as you heard, is changeable. But they should have received that. And if they have not,
they can call the 1-800-MEDICARE number or even check on the Medicare.gov website to find out what plan they've been auto-enrolled in. But that's really important.
So that's something our grantees can always have sort of a flip side to. One of the questions they can ask for folks who are on Medicaid and Medicare is, have you gotten that yellow letter?
Yeah, it's great that they have it on a yellow piece of paper because it's so easy to distinguish.
Another question for the panel?
Emmanuel from Puerto Rico, Chief Program.
Excellent.
It's for David. I would like to have this his website. David what? What's the last name?
Hang on one second. It's Chatel. Let me spell it for you because many people start it with an S when I say it. It's C-H-A-T-E-L. And again, so if you want my email address, it's David.Chatel at cms.hhs.gov. And feel free to email me any specific questions you have.
And also, that brings up a point. There are CMS regional offices throughout the country, and those are a great, correct me if I'm wrong, but that is one of the places CMS is looking to find what the issues are that are bubbling up and becoming of concern. So our grantees can also contact the local CMS regional office to, pass on information they're hearing. Is that right, David?
That's for sure.
Right, and if you go to www.cms.hhs.gov, G-O-V, and you look at the bottom left side of the screen, you'll see an area called Contacts. You click on Contacts, it will ask you for what state you're looking for, and then in the next drop-down menu, click on Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Regional Offices, and it will tell you what regional CMS office covers your particular state and their contact information.
Thank you. We have time for about two or three more questions. Is there anything out there?
I have a question. This is Patty from Indiana. I have a question about the formulary. Will this be reviewed periodically as new drugs come on the market? And I mean, how flexible is it?
That's a good question. This is Leslie. And actually, each plan has what's called a P&T committee, something in therapeutics,
pharmaceutical therapeutic
committee, and they're required to meet at least minimally quarterly, and any kind of new drugs are approved by the FDA, they are reviewed, there's a time period, and they have to review them and decide whether to put them on the formulary. So yes, there is a process for that. But folks should know that formularies can change over the course of a year. However, the plans have to give 60 days written notice to anybody taking the plan, the drug, as well as their prescribing doctor in the pharmacy, or they have to provide 60 days worth of the prescription.
And Leslie, also, any change in the drug formulary must be approved by CMS, so there's another safeguard in there.
You beat me to the punch on that, Denise.
Are there any other questions? I know Diane Bronstein here has one. She's been waving her hand. So, Diane, go ahead.
I have a bunch of very nitty-gritty questions.
So, I've got time for one.
Yeah. For those of us that haven't been actively involved in this, you can look and you can look online, but actual beneficiaries, can they sign up online? Do they have to mail something in? How does the actual signing up work?
Who wants to tackle this one?
It's actually all of the above, almost.
That's true. You can enroll online.
Okay.
You can enroll by calling 1-800-MEDICARE. You can contact the plan directly and enroll over the phone with them. You can call the plan and ask for enrollment information and forms to be sent to you. Or you can go to a partner event where they may have internet connectivity or taking enrollments at that event. So there are a number of different ways to get enrolled.
Okay.
let me just indicate one thing is that I would not, one thing that's not allowed is if one of the plans is doing marketing and they do a cold call to a beneficiary, they are not allowed to enroll at that time.
That's a very good point. And the other stipulation is that a plan, unless they are specifically invited in by a beneficiary into their room in a nursing home, cannot do an enrollment in the room. Any kind of an enrollment event where a plan is going to be present should be done in a public area of the nursing home.
And that's the same with senior housing buildings, et cetera.
Correct.
They can't be going knocking on doors.
Leslie, there's also, you had mentioned the yellow letter earlier, and I just remembered this from a gentleman that I was talking to the other day. If you're already on a plan that meets the standards, should you have already gotten a letter from that, from your current plan? Does that make sense?
You mean if you're auto enrolled?
Right, or if you're on a prescription drug plan already that meets the standards set by.
Oh, I see. That's the what's called the creditable coverage letter.
Yes.
Everyone should have gotten a letter by November 10th from a employer insurance, retiree insurance, Medigap, the VA. Any other insurance company should have sent out that letter saying whether the current insurance is as good as Medicare's or better, or if it's not as good as the Medicare plan. And they should have gotten it. If they did not, they should. If it's through an employer, you should contact probably the HR department. If it's through a Medigap, you should contact the Medigap, because I was actually meeting with someone's mother over this week. She had not gotten her letter from her Medigap insurer. And when she called, when we called, they said, well, they're behind, which was sort of an unacceptable response. It's in the mail.
And the reason that is important is if you are covered under credible coverage by a former employer or a union or another type of plan, you can hold on to that coverage. You don't have to enroll in Part D. And if you decide to enroll in Part D later on, you won't be penalized.
Right.
The other issue is that if you're receiving your health care benefits as well as your prescription drug benefits from that kind of an employer or retiree plan, before you enroll in a Part D, you need to make sure that you don't lose your health in coverage, not just your prescription drug coverage, but your health coverage as a result of enrolling in Part D. So when in doubt, call and ask.
Okay. I'm going to start wrapping things up here. I know, Diane, I interrupted you, so if there was a second part to what you were going to ask.
It's a very quick question. Someone sort of mentioned that if you didn't fall into certain groups of people, there's an option of applying via Social Security. So who are the people, income-wise or age-wise, that would be doing this? And when you say they apply via Social Security, do you mean they have to go to the office, or what does that mean?
Well, I addressed that, so let me try to take a crack at it. Let me give you the income limits, and for a single person, it's $14,300 change, and for a couple, it is $19,200 change. And the resources are $11,500 for an individual and $23,000 for a couple. And it would be an application process, and that application process is managed by Social Security. And certainly you can go to their office, but this is also available online, socialsecurity.gov.
Are these people that in another life we would have thought of would be age-eligible for SSI? Is that population?
Well, it's for people with that limited income and resources, and it goes up to what is 150% of poverty level.
Okay, thank you.
And so, you know, the idea is that outreach here on that group, that group right now would be an underserved group in terms of access to medications, and you talk about health disparities. if we could get all these folks to become eligible and sign up for this, it would really go a long way to closing that gap in terms of medical coverage and health disparities. So that's why I think it's imperative to try to get the message out to that group.
I just want to jump in, and then I have to leave because someone needs this conference room where I am in Chicago, is that people can also apply at their local state Medicaid offices, and they can ask that it be reviewed there because there the state Medicaid office also has to screen the individual for Medicare Savings Program eligibility, which is so under-enrolled and it's a huge financial benefit for low-income people.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, but I have to hang up. Sorry.
All right. Thank you very much for your participation. I'm going to let everyone go here in just a moment, but I did want to let you know that today from the Alzheimer's Association, something was put together as far as a Medicare Part D update that addresses multilingual Medicare Part D enrollment assistance resources. A lot of our grantees are dealing with special populations. The National Alliance for Hispanic Health has some resources. The National Asian Pacific Center on Aging has resources. And I'll be sending this out to the grantees and the other people who have RSVP'd to this teleconference. And it has a lot of other information on dual eligibles and on practical tips for counseling people about Medicare prescription drug coverage. A little plug for CMS, they are doing a webcast on this very topic on December 14th at 2 o'clock Eastern. But I'll be sending that out and along with the agenda for that as well. I'd like to thank Leslie, who's off the phone, with Jennifer Mitar here, David Chappelle and Denise Benning at CMS, and Courtney Cherney in Illinois. I'd like to thank you all for your participation and for being resources today and continuing on about this issue. And I'd also like to offer Lori any parting thoughts.
Oh, yes, thank you. This is phenomenal. Thank you all very, very much. I've been jotting down furiously, checking out websites as you speak, and all of these resources. I really hope people will go look to them. I was checking on the Medicare.gov website and was interested to see that there's a partnership with the NCOA Benefits Checkup RX, which it looks like has helped people just sort of get some basic information. I also saw on that cms.hhs.gov website, there's a toolkit called Family First based on the program that aired, and it says the 1-800 Medicare line is 24/7. Is that accurate?
That's correct.
So I think that's something, you know, I didn't hear said, but I happened to read, and that's 24/7. So, you know, when you wake up in the middle of the night, give them a call, right? Because they're there and they want to do something. And I appreciate you giving out these resources, your email addresses, and just thank you so very much. I think this was, I found this invaluable myself.
And so everyone knows, feel free to use this teleconference as a resource because it has been recorded and will be posted on the ADDGS grantee website. And we should have that up as soon as humanly possible. If there's nothing else, we will see you next year. Thank you for being part of this teleconference. And again, if you have any questions, we will certainly, you can email me and I'll certainly make sure that the question goes to the right panelist. And you have their contact information as well, and we'll be sending out a lot of information on this issue probably later today. So thank you very much for taking the hour out of your day, and we hope we'll see you again.
Happy holidays.
Happy New Year.